Hello, it's Thomas. Welcome to episode 25 of Is This Democracy? This week, I am talking to literary scholar and cultural critic Adrian Delp. It's the second consecutive episode with Adrian. If you haven't yet, please go back and listen to last week's show in which Adrian and I took a deep dive into the cancel culture moral panic, what it can tell us about US society, culture, and politics, and how it has spread across the quote-unquote West. That conversation was based on Adrian's latest book, Cancel Culture Transfer, How a Moral Panic is Gripping the World, which came out last fall. But before that, in 2020, Adrian published a book titled What Tech Calls Thinking, an inquiry into the intellectual bedrock of Silicon Valley. The book made big waves when it came out because it took a really unusual, innovative look at Silicon Valley, applying Adrian's skills as a literary and cultural scholar, as someone who is trained to dissect and analyze the stories we tell, the narratives that help us make sense of the world to, in a way, his immediate surroundings. Because Adrian is a professor of comparative literature and German studies at Stanford University, where he specializes in culture and politics of the 19th century, as well as questions of gender and sexuality. So he is at the source, so to speak, in a place that is shaped and dominated by the tech industry like probably no other in the world. And he decided to not just be a literary and cultural scholar in Silicon Valley, but a literary and cultural scholar of Silicon Valley. I should say that we recorded both last week's and this week's episode in one long session. So by the time we got to tackling what tech calls thinking, Adrian and I had already talked about cancel culture for a long time. This episode definitely still stands on its own, no problem. But if you haven't yet, I certainly highly recommend going back to last week's discussion of the cancel culture moral panic, because I do think that together they form a relatively coherent whole. In last week's show, we also talked about Adrian's path from Germany, where he grew up, to Stanford, and from being a scholar of 19th century German philosophy, literature, poetry, and culture, to someone who is, in a way, in the trenches of the US culture wars, who is out there commenting on the political conflict. That's a question we pick up again at the beginning of this episode. What was the impetus for Adrian to write What Tech Calls Thinking? Why is it important to dissect the philosophies Silicon Valley is built on, the stories it likes to tell about itself? We then talk about why tech giants like Peter Thiel and Elon Musk are so fixated on certain figures, certain philosophers, who are trying to outline the philosophical and ideological universe that shapes the imaginary of Silicon Valley. And we discuss how it helps us understand what is driving people like Thiel and Musk, how it translates into their politics, specifically how it helps us make sense of the very pronounced tech libertarian to far-right pipeline. And then finally, we talk about why so many people, so many in the liberal camp specifically, have been, until recently at least, under the impression that these tech giants were political allies, and why so many have been willing to accept them as not just business people, but as thinkers in their own right, people whose thoughts about the world matter somehow that we should listen to, why our culture has glorified them as visionaries, and whether or not that is finally changing. On all of these questions, Adrian offers some actual deep thinking. I can only recommend you all follow his work. The best way to keep up with his unbelievable production is to go to his personal website at adriandelp.com. He also has his own podcast, The Feminist Present, and you should all subscribe to his fantastic Substack newsletter, Dreams in the Witch House, where he tackles many of the issues we discuss here. Before we get into it, just a few housekeeping items. If you haven't yet, please subscribe on the podcast player of your choice. If you want to support the podcast, the best way to do that is to leave us a rating or a review. These ratings and reviews, they really help us tremendously, help us let the world know that the podcast even exists. If you have any feedback, please email us at isthisdemocracypod@gmail.com. Thanks as always to our wonderful producer, Connor Lynch, who is making all this good stuff happen. And now, without further ado, here is my conversation with Adrian Delp. You wrote, or rather you published, What Tech Calls Thinking, an inquiry into the intellectual bedrock of Silicon Valley in 2020. What's the impetus for this book? Again, I don't want to harp too much on, hey, you are a scholar of like German culture and literature.
Yeah.
When and why did you decide, hey, this is something I should investigate that needs investigating? When did you decide, I guess that is sort of my main question here, when did you decide it was not enough to talk about money and profit and capitalism, but we should also talk about stories and narratives and philosophies and cultures?
Yeah, I mean, I think I had the idea that it needed to be studied for quite some time. What took a while is for me to work up the courage to actually write a book about it.
Yeah.
Because of course, there are things that we all study and are interested in that we understand is not really like others are more more appropriate to write about them. I think I got interested in these ideas partly because editors kept asking me to write about them, and I found that again, this kind of weird distance between Silicon Valley and both Europe and the East Coast kind of bred misunderstandings that the tech companies were only too happy to exploit. And there was this kind of, at the time, a very sort of fawning coverage of Silicon Valley that really seemed to treat these companies as most of all carriers of ideas. They were titans of disruption. They were works of genius, right? All the things that we see Elon Musk kind of parody out of existence right now. Back then, people kind of believed this stuff, you know, and, you know, failure is no longer, has lost its bite, and they know what you really want, or they're university dropouts, but they know much more than any college graduate ever could. All these myths were kind of swallowed uncritically by these media, and living here and interacting with people at these companies made very clear to me that, like, it wasn't that this is all a lie. It was just that the real world was more complicated. This was a narrative schema that we were being offered that made certain things invisible, that made certain stories seem obvious and other stories untellable. And frankly, schemata that tended to unite critics and boosters. Like, for every single innovation of those years, there was someone like, this is going to end this as X as we know it, or like, this disruption will destroy. Blah, 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 blah. It's like, well, that's what they told you. That's in their pitch deck. That's for investors. You know, it's like believing that like a juicer that gets advertised to you at QVC can really do what it does. It's like, you understand what a commercial is, right? Similarly, right, like we talked a lot about like the chain at the time I was living here in San Francisco, and, you know, I was thinking about, tech workers were all about, and like San Francisco sort of like was like sort of chic to hate on tech workers. And what that meant was we meant coders and programmers. And of course, like, there are so many other people who work in these companies, but who sort of never come into view because like somehow they don't really matter. And it was a weird thing that like programmers tended to agree with. The people like, you know, trying to hold back the Google bus or like trying to demonstrate a blockade the Google bus, right? Like, we all seem to agree on these certain things. And I'm like, well, why are we letting this place kind of rework our mental, our categorical apparatus uncritically, even if we think we're being critical of them? Surely we need to be a little bit more careful about these ideas and where they come from. And that's where this idea sort of started for me, that I would trace individual ideologies of Silicon Valley and sort of explain where they come from and what's implied in them and what's not, right? And like how we might think differently about them. And one of the things that then gave me the confidence to finally write the book about it was that, you know, I had students in the early 20-teens who wanted to go into Silicon Valley, and that was fine. I'm okay with that. But they kept parroting back this, like, you know, we want to make the world a better place. We don't want to do evil, yeah, blah, blah. I'm like, ooh, kids, like, I'm here teaching you Adorno and Marx, and you can work for Facebook. That's fine, but don't fucking parrot this shit back to me. Like, that's ridiculous. Like, I taught you better than that, didn't I? Well, funny thing that happened on the way to the printer is basically as I was writing the book, these students had taken 5, 7, 8 years to actually work at a couple of these companies, and they come back to my office hours and give me their critiques of these places. And in many ways were extremely astute, some from a more Marxist lens, some from an identity politics lens, didn't matter. But they'd gone into it precisely with the kinds of critical faculties that a good education, which I think we provide at Stanford, had given them. And their kind of feedback really reaffirmed me in wanting to write this book. And then I thought, we have, as a culture, pretty good resources to draw on. We have expertise to draw on to think about these tech companies, right? What tech calls thinking does to these resources is that we're being told not to tap them. Don't talk to politicians about regulation. Don't talk to unions about organizing labor. That's all 1.0. We're going 2.0, 3.0, whatever, right? Like, and in the end, it turns out we have a good number of inherited resources that we can draw on. And essentially, I found that my students were availing themselves in really wonderful ways, my ex-students. And so I thought, like, yeah, I want to write a book that strengthens that, that gives people confidence in those, or at least a fighting chance to apply them when very powerful interests tell them not to.
So it's really striking that leading Silicon Valley or tech quote-unquote geniuses, like Peter Thiel and Elon Musk or people like that, there's a specific universe of writers and thinkers that seem to play a prominent role in their sort of collective imaginary. Some of them are the usual suspects of, you know, every self-proclaimed libertarian discovered in their teenage years and then somehow never moved beyond, like Ayn Rand or whatever. But some are more obscure figures, like French philosopher René Girard, who, frankly, I was not aware of at all until I started reading your work. So can you outline a little bit, like, what kind of thinker, what kind of figure are they gravitating towards? What kind of philosophy or outlook on the world? What is it that they are seeking? And what is it that they are getting out of these specific people and these people's ideas?
Yeah. The book basically delves into different ones, but it is arranged with a logic in mind. And the first one is on dropping out, because to some extent, that was to me my method chapter, even though I don't call it that. That's not that kind of book. But because initially I thought I'd call it an intellectual history of Silicon Valley. And I thought that's not right. Because A, there is a serious intellectual history to be told, but it's probably about questions about programming, about the digital, et cetera, et cetera. And frankly, we don't turn to Elon Musk for that. There are really interesting people who've worked their lives at HP, at Google, et cetera, who you probably could write that about, but they're not going to give interviews. I mean, they might, but like they're not going to get a big profile. So the people I'm interested in are the ones that the kind of founder class draws on to justify and explicate their endeavors. One thing that they all have in common is they cannot be safely situated within the university. Now, René Girard is kind of the odd one out, right? The other people I deal with, Ayn Rand, not an academic philosopher, not taken seriously in the academy. Marshall McLuhan is a professor, but definitely had a kind of pop cultural reception outside of the university. So these kinds of folks, I think, are sort of within shouting distance of the university, but they're not quite there. And René Girard, in Peter Thiel's telling, is actually quite similar. He was in my department. He was a tenured professor for a good part of his life. But if you ask Thiel about him, it's like, well, he was never quite accepted and he was always an outsider. Da, da, da. That's what you want. You want an outsider, someone who every other academic philosopher thinks is awesome. You're not going to get the time of day from these guys, right? Partly because in an article for a newspaper years ago, I called this the metaphysics for nerds. It's a metaphysics that not everyone has access to, right? It has to be counterintuitive. It has to be countercultural. It has to be counter-majoritarian, right? Another way of putting this is like, and this is why it often tends conservative, there's a certain kind of esotericism. If you think about people like Leo Strauss, right? Like there's a kind of hidden knowledge that you have access to and that the great mass of people does not. Right. And that is something that all these thinkers have in common. And then the other one is it can't be cool, I think. It has to be so uncool that it's cool again. And there I want to point people to an intellectual lineage that I didn't talk much about in the book because I sort of felt it wasn't quite of the same level as a chapter on Rand or on McLuhan. What's Peter Thiel's big company called? Palantir, right? Like, why is the metaverse called the metaverse? A lot of this is basically taken from science fiction and fantasy that they liked to read as, again, like as juveniles. There's something inherently juvenile about these absorptions, right? There's a reason, I'm guessing, why Apple TV Plus is making a Foundation by Isaac Asimov into a TV show. There's a reason why Dune is having such a big renaissance. Like these are the kinds of heavy, hefty science fiction books that these kids probably, or these people got beaten up on the schoolyard for when they were 14, and now they're making them into their shield, right? And I think that's another big part of this kind of nerd oppositionality, kind of nerd apartness, right? Of kind of being the outsider. That's extremely important, both for the thinkers and for the motifs that they eventually grab onto from these books.
I mean, I should also say, this is so obvious, you probably don't even say that anymore, but it's also, they very obviously don't gravitate towards thinkers and ideas that would in any way maybe sort of question power or sort of undermine the use of power, right? Or sort of what they gravitate towards is something that justifies and legitimizes the powerful using power, right? Does that make sense? Or is it, yeah. I mean,
they're minoritarian philosophies, right, often. Although yeah. I should say both McLuhan and Girard, I don't know if that's entirely truthful, right? McLuhan is ultimately yeah. kind of a media anarchist. But of course, you can read him in a way.
Yeah, it's like, the perception, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Like you can, so they can make versions of this that basically do what you say that they do. I mean, for instance, their cult of disruption clearly is informed by the thought of the economist Joseph Schumpeter, who's drawing it from Marx. they're literally drawing on the Communist Manifesto to, let's say, the least communist means ever devised in the history of man, basically. It's just, yeah. So they can make them fit, right, yeah. in certain yeah. ways. But yes, the idea, and again, like, you know, if you've read your Dune, right, the kind of anarchy that comes from the Muad'Dib is what they like, right? The idea yes. that, like, the charismatic genius leader figure, they want to go yes. to John Galt, right? Like, they're fine with power being unsettled, but by someone that is them, that is a not super thinly veiled stand-in for them, you know?
And the end result of that is you can be disruptive. You can disrupt sort of existing power. That's fine. But the end result, the utopia, is not one of leveled hierarchies, right? The end result is one that has them unconstrained by collective forces that would hold them back in their genius.
I mean, the end result can be now described actually in vocabulary that I wouldn't have drawn on in my 2020 book. Look at Elon Musk's Twitter blue check project, right? He thinks he says he's leveling the playing field. There were all these entrenched elites that had hogged all these blue checks. Now he's going to give them away for just a low, low price of $8 a month. And of course, you might point out to Elon Musk that there is a description for a system in which everyone is treated equally under a person who doles out favors for a tithe. It's called feudalism. He's invented feudalism around the blue check. But it gives you a pretty good example. Like he frames this as a great leveling gesture. And the many, you know, court sycophants that, you know, follow him down every dumb rabbit hole he goes down, seem to agree with him on this. They think that this is, they're sticking it to the elites. You know, people often ask me, like, oh, how did you predict the conservative turn of people like Elon Musk? Like, it doesn't take much predicting, because in some way, for someone who, as you said earlier, like, you know, has been in the culture war trenches for a little bit, I do know how to recognize people rethinking what an elite is and pretending like, you know, college students are the elite, but a Republican governor is not. Well, it wasn't hard to look at Silicon Valley and be like, oh, you're doing the same thing. The elite in this case is a taxi driver, and not the elite is SoftBank, and it's $10 billion stake in your company. Okay, so it seems like maybe we have hollowed out the idea of elitism, you know, and of elites beyond recognition. But this is a thing that Elon Musk always believed. He thought that cave divers telling him that his robot wouldn't work, that was the elite. He himself was just like the spunky inventor, and he was outside of these power structures, right? I think that is a place where the modern conservative movement and Silicon Valley just kind of agree.
It's a shared disposition of elite sort of self-victimization, right? Where they all have to make sense of and rationalize a weird gap, which is between being immensely powerful, right, and being in a position of power and influence, but also feeling persecuted, right? And they have to kind of make sense of that somehow. And it's the same with, if there's one constant in modern conservatism, it is that they at any point have felt like we are the victims of these powerful forces of liberalism and leftism and whatever. And it has never aligned with their actual socioeconomic or political status in terms of actual power relations. But it's also not an act. They don't look in the mirror, or at least, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but my sense is not that these people look in the mirror in the evening before they go to bed and say, ha, I made everyone buy into this crap. And they don't even understand that I don't. They believe this, right? They believe this tale of like being the victims, being persecuted, for whatever reason, and with these tech giants, it's usually because for their genius, they're being persecuted precisely because they're these sort of individual sort of geniuses. But that, I mean, just like you said, that seems to be a shared disposition that sort of has them almost naturally or inevitably gravitate towards sort of right-wing reactionary political projects.
So I think that's right. I do think that one can almost go one step further with them. I don't know what does it for someone like Donald Trump or what
sure.
does for someone like Ron DeSantis. Yeah. I think I can say a little bit more about the Silicon Valley tycoons that think this way. My impression is twofold. One is a lot of them, I think, were pushed into this victim complex by their time on social media. There's this very funny thing where like VC Twitter is like among the funniest fucking things you could ever see. Cause it's like all these dummies kind of shooting off their mouths and then getting beaten down by people who like clearly take joy in the fact that like they probably will make in their lifetime a millionth of what this person made in their lifetime. But like at this one time, like you really stepped in it and I'm going to make you feel it. And like, they're just like clowning on these people. And I've often thought about like why that's almost like a rite of passage, why like a certain kind of rich dude in Silicon Valley somehow like has to have their half-baked idiot idea that like then gets them kind of like not quite canceled, but like that gets that arouses contradiction from people that they could probably have murdered for like a fraction of their fortune. And I think one of the answers is these are people, usually young men who made their money and probably realized that like they made their most salient contributions to the world at an absurdly, obscenely young age. And I have observed in my students that one thing the tech industry often does is it pushes you into having crises earlier and earlier in life. Because like, you know, you and I have the advantage of being in a field where, I mean, this is not much of an advantage, but the one advantage it has is that we will peak kind of at a later time in our lives, right? And by the time we decline in our life, in our importance in our field, we will cognitively decline too. So hopefully we'll notice. We'll just like yell about cancel culture or whatever, right? Like yeah. It's fine. But like these are people who like realize, oh shit, the app I started at 24 may be the most lasting contribution I will ever make. And now I just sit in my multi-million dollar mansion in like Palo Alto or Hillsdale or Los Gatos. And I just kind of shoot my mouth up on Twitter and hope that it connects with people, which usually means that either some sycophants who want my VC money like agree with me, or someone who I've never met, you know, Twitterati 443 like calls me an idiot or whatever. And I'm gonna go like nuts over that on my toilet here while tweeting. And I think that they do experience themselves as victim. And think about the fact that like those are most of the people they meet in a day, probably. Right? Like these are isolated existences in some way. These are not people who go to work very much anymore. They didn't really know that many people when they were at work. They are resting on laurels. They live fairly isolated lives. They're surrounded by yes men or people who basically function as their blood bags, right? Like, so they can do, they can use their blood to stay forever young or whatever. Like it's a weird fucking life to lead. And I can sort of imagine that like, if most people who aren't that, who aren't working for you, are people who shout you down for your dumbass ideas about like success stories or whatever, like, yeah, you're going to feel like a victim a little bit. And so I think it does come out of their lived existence to some extent.
Yeah. So there's at least two big misunderstandings that I think, at least until quite recently, have been very prevalent amongst liberals, broadly speaking, about the tech world and these, you know, these tech geniuses. One is that they are themselves liberals, or at least broadly aligned with sort of the progressive cause, right? And the other one is that they are thinkers in their own right, that we should not only buy their products, but listen to what they have to say about life, the world, the universe, right? Clearly, their misunderstandings, their misconceptions. Where do they come from?
They're companies financed entirely by billionaires. I mean, yes. Like how lefty is this going to get? They're all founded on the suppression of labor movements. Like,
yeah. But so there's this misunderstanding and this weird but very pervasive idea that they're not just entrepreneurs, they're not just business people, they have something profound to contribute about the human condition or whatever. Where does that start? Where does it come from? Why is that?
Well, I mean, it's hard to say. Some of it is the regional appeal. I mean, this region of Northern California, where Silicon Valley is located, has long thrived on that. And of course, there was on the kind of a sense that, like, this is where kind of an expansion of our ideas about cohabiting, of working together, of technology sort of comes from, right? This starts with the 1960s, the counterculture. And it was really kind of like a way in which this area kind of articulated its own identity vis-a-vis other places. So that's probably why it's not the tech industry, it's the Valley, right, that really has done this, right? Like, I'm guessing that, like, probably the tech industry in Texas explains itself in very different ways, right? So that's one thing. But the other thing is, of course, that was always also used by these companies. I mean, this is maybe a little too pedestrian, but it might be a point worth making. A lot of these companies needed a ton of what is in Silicon Valley called a runway, right? They needed lots of money to be thrown at them at times when they weren't making any. Well, that is easier to do if you can convince people of a certain set of ideas. Really, right? Like, you have to say, like, there's something about this. Here's our theory of the case. I know right now we're hemorrhaging cash, but if you think about it this way, it's actually a good investment. In some cases, this was true, right? Amazon appears to have been true. In some cases, it was utter bullshit, right? Like Theranos. And in many cases, think Uber, it was somewhere in between, right? There may have been a case somewhere along the line where they could have done this. I think that turnoff has clearly been missed. And I think that it's going to eventually, it will not make money, it doesn't seem like. But in any way, that sort of pushed two things into the forefront. It pushed ideas, right? Our vision, we're not just a company. And it thrust into the forefront these founding figures, right? We have to have a fun, nerdy 24-year-olds with a weird voice who, like, stands in front of a giant screen and, like, squawks at you about, like, we want to change the way people make cat pictures or whatever. Like, who gives a shit, right? Like, it's whatever it was, right? Like, you had to have this big figure, this kind of semi-messianic figure. Then maybe we might add a third thing, which sort of came much later. As Silicon Valley really revved up, one thing that I think maybe, unless I don't know how much time you've spent out here, one thing that is very true for the tech industry, at least during its heyday, was that people hopped companies all the time.
Mm.
You were employed by one of these companies for a year, two, three tops. If you were at an unexciting company, even though it was paying you well for 3 or 4 years, it would start eating at your soul because, like, people were like, what is he doing there? It's just a bank, or it's just a this, it's just a that. Like, no, you got to get to the new startup, right? And especially among younger people, obviously, like, once people hit their 30s and 40s, they couldn't really do this. But it was pretty important. And so one of the rules of the game was, how do you exploit young people's labor as quickly and as efficiently as humanly possible?
Yeah.
And well, one way to do that is to say, well, you're not really working here. It's not just a company. We are a family and we are on a mission, right? Are you sufficiently mission-minded? Are you down for the cause, right? And, you know, I understand that probably most of us don't feel super bad for people who make $200,000 a year and are 25 years old, but it was also a system designed to exploit them. And, you know, in some way, they don't deserve exploitation any more than anyone else does. And a lot of this was actually there internally initially to make sure that they didn't jump ship, that they did that overtime, right? Like, we often talk about them as, like, very pampered, right? Like, oh, we'll do your laundry for you. We'll park your car for you. We'll feed you. We'll make your burrito, blah, blah, blah. Well, all this was also just a way to make sure they never left the premises, you know. And so that's the other thing, that a lot of it was about extractive labor practices. And you can't do that by being like, yes, this is a workplace like any other, but we're not going to let you go on vacation. Like,
yes,
I might want to choose a workplace that does allow me to do that, right? And instead, it's like, you know, no, that's the old way of looking at it. This is a hip, cool new place. I mean, Elon Musk, like, sleeping at Twitter and, like, the few remaining Twitter people, like, taking pictures of their cots is like, I'm so mad that there hasn't been a second edition of the book yet, because, like, I could just have that as the cover. It's like, oh my God, it's like a dark, like, parodic version of what I sort of suspected was behind this all this time, right? Like, what was the Musk phrase? Oh, super hardcore. You need to be super hardcore.
Yes. Right?
Which has it all. It's like, we're not just a business. Also, This is about masculinity, just in case you were wondering. Are you a real man? And a real man does what? He types on a computer keyboard all day long, right? Real alpha male shit, right?
The manliest stuff in the history of humankind.
I know. it's what the Vikings did. They just like showed up with their laptops and they threw them at the Irish monks, you know. It's all there. Like, this is why it's sexist. That's why it's classist. That's why it is low-key racist, right? Like, he manages to get it all out on paper that like one had to painstakingly draw out between the years 2015 and 2020.
I want to add one sort of half-baked idea to this, and you'll tell me what you think of this. I've not had the chance to spend a lot of time thinking this through, but it seems to me on the sort of perception side, on the side of why does liberal America, broadly speaking, eat this stuff up, right? What you just described. I think part of this is also a sort of 90s post-Cold War kind of story of at the height of sort of neoliberal hegemony, which clearly the 90s was, right? So there's this new generation of center-left political leaders in the quote-unquote West, like Bill Clinton and Tony Blair and Gerd Schröder in Germany. They fully bought into this general idea that the era of grand ideological struggle was over and it had given way to a new era of sort of just capitalist democracy reigning supreme. And in that view, the only way forward was to embrace this sort of techno-utopian globalization without any reservation. And all that was left to do then for governments was in this sort of post-historical, post-ideological age, was just to manage progress as efficiently as possible. And these guys, again, Clinton and Blair and Schröder, they fully bought into this idea of, I mean, I just read with my students in a class that I taught this last semester on the 90s, this sort of manifesto that UK Prime Minister Blair and German Chancellor Schröder published in 1998. They called it Europe the Third Way, or Die Neue Mitte, the New Middle. I mean, Elon Musk himself could not have said it any better, right? Like, there's this sentence in there, I'm going to quote it because I find it so bizarre. We want a society which celebrates successful entrepreneurs just as it does artists and footballers. And the kind of entrepreneur that they're describing is the kind of individual genius type, right? And so that aligns really well with sort of the Musks and the Teals of this world. And they, of course, were all too willing to play along and present a sort of culturally permissive image. And they probably are sort of culturally permissive. They're not like religious conservatives, or most of them probably aren't, right? And that, I think, all contributed to this sense that created this complete misunderstanding that this was somehow in line with or compatible with social democratic goals of what society should be. Because again, these are center-left political leaders, right, that go all in on this vision. And I think there's something very sort of Clinton America about this misperception of, oh, this is awesome. They're coming to the White House. I'm going to invite these people to the White House. And of course, they go to the White House because they love that kind of attention and that sort of stuff, right? I think there's something there where you can see why the sort of post-Cold War, supposedly post-historical, post-ideological, neoliberal mindset is absolutely on board with this kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think that's right. I do think that, like, the other thing, of course, is that at least in the United States, I think one misunderstanding was, like, two points, which I'm not sure if that's true in every country, but like here, very clearly, the tech industry offered a vision of capitalism that could kind of explain and mitigate kind of the industrial decline, right? Yeah. Like the famous learn to code, right? We gotta get the coal miners to learn how to code. There's that. And then there's the other part of it that I think you're alluding to, which is that the extractive capitalist interests that are frequently associated with right-wing causes in the United States, like, are very obviously anti-labor. Right. So, like, think of the coal industry, think of the oil industry. On the other hand, like, these were companies that said, oh, we don't really have any laborers, right? We have, like, only these well-paid programmers, and then we don't have any laborers. Turns out they have tons. They just didn't acknowledge them as such, right? And so if you squinted, it could seem like everyone at Facebook is so happy with the work. It's like, well, no, everyone who does a particular kind of work at Facebook is reasonably happy with their work. Ask the content moderators, ask the, you know, people clicking through pictures in the Philippines, ask the people who are, right, running the server farms, like, whatever it is. But because that was kind of out of sight, out of mind, and frequently, frankly, not in the United States, it sort of wasn't clear that these were industrialists that were in control of gigantic labor forces that had the exact same incentives as a coal baron in West Virginia would. And it took a little while for that to become obvious, right? As in the 80s and 90s, right, where like the ravages of deindustrialization first were visited upon communities of color and then got interpreted in these kind of racist ways as like, well, it's their problem, until in the 90s it really fully hit sort of any town USA and hit white Americans. I think something similar is happening here, that like basically it took a little while for these companies' labor pools to become obvious as who they all comprised. And initially it just immiserated people in places that the US government doesn't really much care about. And now it has come back to actually, you know, rewrite and rework labor here.
My final question, because we have been going on for a very long time.
Long time.
Final question. So my sense is, and maybe it's just the hope, the fool's friend, my sense is that the aura around these Silicon Valley titans seems diminished. Maybe there is less buy-in now for the idea that everything they think and say is so profound. Maybe there's also, in general, a more critical attitude towards the idea of these particular types of technologies leading us to a utopian future anytime soon. And maybe more of an awareness that what's really behind the utopian rhetoric these guys like to use is a utopia for the rich and powerful, right? Where they can leave the planet behind and all the dirty masses of people like us. Are we changing our view of them as sort of poet geniuses and profit tycoons? Has that maybe peaked? Are we kind of sort of finally opening our eyes to what's going on? Or is that not something you see?
I think in some aspects it's undeniable that that's happening. I think that Elon Musk is doing his part to just kind
yes.
of recapitulate all the dumbest tropes of the genius adulation of the last 20 years, and everyone can sort of see how few clothes the emperor really is wearing. So I think, I absolutely think so, on the one hand. On the other hand, I do think some of these habits, like with the moral panics we started out with, are pretty ingrained. I do worry around things like AI, that a lot of the same warnings and promises are being made, and people are like, oh, they say they can do this. It's like, well, they would say that. It's their product. Don't relax, you know, like ask some questions, you know. And again, we are erasing labor, right? Like a lot of these, ChatGPT is not a labor-free thing. Like there are a lot of people unseen by me and you who make that system work. So I do think that there are some habits, unfortunately, that we have carried forward from that era, and we're going to have to unlearn over time. But I do think the chance of us unlearning them successfully and developing a better critical vocabulary is a little bit better than for some others. I think we're in much better shape now than we would have been than we were 10 years ago, and I think that we can be reasonably optimistic that this sort of cultural dominance, with so little obvious pushback, is not coming back anytime soon.
I mean, how about that, right? Maybe Peter Thiel openly siding with Trump and funding far-right GOP candidates, and far-right might be a euphemism here, and Musk going all in on being just a far-right troll in the most obvious, most ridiculous fashion. Maybe that was finally too much, right? Maybe they have finally overstepped just a little bit. That is probably a good place to end. A somewhat hopeful place to end,
yeah,
I guess.
That's where I like to end. Somewhat hopeful.
Yeah. Yes, somewhat hopeful. Look, we went long. It is such a pleasure to talk all this stuff through with you. I'm learning so much from talking to you and thinking this through with you. Everyone, you should all read and follow Adrian's work. We mentioned some of his academic work on German literature and culture. I'll specifically highlight, again, the two books that deal directly with the topics we have discussed here on the podcast. One is What Tech Calls Thinking, an Inquiry into the Intellectual Bedrock of Silicon Valley, that came out in 2020. The other is so far only available in German, but an English version is in the works, right? Is that correct?
It is, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes, so that is, I'm giving you a translated title. I'm not sure if that is the English title. Cancel Culture Transfer, How a Moral Panic is Gripping the World. Is that going to be the English title?
Not sure. We're still trying to figure that out, yeah.
Anyway, that book came out last year, 2022. Beyond that, read all the many, many pieces Adrian writes for major outlets, newspapers, magazines. If you want to keep up with what he's doing, I'll recommend you check out his website. It's adriandaub.com. Also, read his wonderful Substack newsletter, Dreams in the Witch House, which is just one of the smartest, most incisive analysis that you'll get anywhere. I'm really glad we had a chance to get into it here on the podcast. Adrian Daub, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you so much, Thomas.